No, this is almost rapid fire. I'm almost like solving people's problems. Who's got a problem? Next.
Then hit me. Next. Shopper Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Chop Talk Show. I'm Dave Scoots Rupert, and with me is Chris Beep Bop Lead at That Coyer. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm the Jazz Man.
Ski bop 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 bop.
I loved the bad guy in the latest season of Samurai Jack. If you haven't seen Samurai Jack, you should watch it. But there's a, you know, that he came back after a long hiatus, and like one of the bad guys was like this like jazz man bad guy. Yeah. Hey, Jackie boy, man. Oh, he was just it was such a good, he was so enthusiastic about being a bad guy with jazzy voice. It was the best.
Mm-hmm. All right. He's just kind of a like spicy bad guy, spicy villain. I like my villains like I like my burrito supremes. Yeah. Hey, Chris, what are we doing here today? You got no guests in the studio. Oh my gosh.
What's no. This?
Just quiet in here, isn't it? Crickets.
But it is.
Guess what we got?
Bread and butter.
We got a big old plate of meat and potatoes. We got a big old plate of meat and potatoes right here. It's a bunch of questions. And it might even be like old school, like rapid fire style, because some pretty knockout questions, I think. But
are they good?
That's the
kind I like.
I picked a couple out of the old question hopper, which if you got more questions, please send them in. We always like to try to answer your questions as poorly as possible. So
yeah, I'd like to see a CSS question.
Oh, yeah. No one uses CSS anymore, Chris.
Why do people want life advice from me? My God, of all the unqualified people to give out life advice.
Hey, speaking of life advice, I'm here at the magazine corner. Magazine corner here, Chris. We're powering through James Corden's 132 Secrets of the Most Protective People, brought to you by Fast Company and James Corden. Bernard Tyson, chairman and CEO of Kaiser Permanente, your favorite tech company. Chris, guess what he does? He wakes up between 5 and 6 a.m. Every day, and he always sets an alarm no matter what time zone, okay? And then the first thing he does, pray, check email, and exercise while watching the news. All right, but his secret to being successful is I compartmentalize everything.
That's it? It's a one-liner?
Well, there's like a whole article and I didn't read it. So, yeah, but like three paragraphs and I didn't read them. But it's kind of like in order to maintain good mental health and wellness in the midst of stressful lives, much of my daily routine is intended to create balance. I compartmentalize everything. It's the way I focus. I like to have my stuff in specific folders clearly marked for those specific projects or initiatives. For example, every day I get a folder of all my meetings and I put a little tag on the top of the folder to specify the contents. And, I don't know. I kind of want to just sit back and go nerd, but, but the previous one on a couple episodes back or whatever, she mentioned that she does to-do lists, very strict on to-do lists. So maybe this is the secret we're cracking here of productive people. Thank you, James Corden, for all that inspiration here. And Chris. Breaking news. I got two back because I went on a business trip the other week.
Nice. Yeah, I go on Tuesday to New York for Miranda's got a thing. So.
And this one is Wired magazine with a punched out, what's his face? Zuck on there, which it's very interesting. I picked it up because I'm sure it's just he's getting beaten down over certain accepting of rubles for certain advertisements. But I don't know. And then I got this world's 50 most innovative companies. I was hoping Paravel would be on the top, but we did not make it this year, Chris.
That's too bad. I'm susceptible to those too. They're always like, It's just, I know it's just junk food. You know, it's not like I'm going to read that magazine and become a better entrepreneur all of a sudden, but.
Yeah. Just, why didn't, no one's coming to us. I just, you know, like, oh, well, maybe next time. Well, that's our goal. New goal for the Shop Talk Show. Get in Fast Company. If you work for Fast Company or an editor there, please reach out to us. newsinquiries.shoptalk@shoptalk.newsinquiries.com.
I'm Chris at armchairtechpundit.com.
Yes. Yes. I have over 10 YouTube subscribers. Please, please reach out. Hey, Chris, Germbo Law writes in. I'm in loving advances in CSS lately. CSS Grid is a powerful tool. Combining that with Flexbox, there's not much we cannot do. I like that optimism, but it's not quite solving every problem. Uh-oh. I feel like anti-cancer things should be doable with today's technology, but I'm having a hard time getting this to work.
That was a joke. I think that was a joke.
I think that's the not literal anti-cancer. I think just anti- awful stuff things should be so I feel like good things should be doable with today's technology, but I'm having a hard time getting this to work. My question is, where is element queries at? Media queries are a great, but if I want the same component on my desktop in two locations, how can I adapt one large container to the other smaller container, much like it'd work on screen sizes? Media queries allow me to target screen sizes to change the visual presentation. Can we do the same thing, but on the same screen size? So media queries, very viewport based. What's the size of the viewport? Element queries or container queries, as they're often called as well, would be to the parent element's width. Like, what, based on the parent element, this is how I want this child element to behave and look and respond. Right. Is that a pretty good summation?
It is, and we've talked about this a number of times. Like, where are they at? I think I even made a prediction at one point. I should check the calendar on there. I can't remember what it was, but let's say it's like something about a year from now, we'll be talking about them in more of a real capacity. Mike, it's browser vendors absolutely know that we want them. There's no mystery. There's no conversation happening there that where they're unclear that developers want these things. It would unlock massive potential. It's a great idea. Please, please, please give them to us. There's also been articles posted about why they're so hard. One of the reasons has to do with circularity or something. That one seems like the sort of solvable problem because it already kind of exists in some context in CSS. Imagine, like, I remember that I had this ancient blog post on CSS tricks of called CSS Jitter Man, and the idea was that you'd hover over him. He was a little stick figure guy, and as you hovered over him, his width property would change to, you know, 100 pixels or something, and then you when you're hovered off from him, his width would be 500 pixels. So, well, imagine what happens then. You know, you hover over the left edge of him and the width changes, which means you're not hovered on top of him anymore, and then his width changes back, and then so the browser freaks out and goes, you know, CSS already has some circularity problems like that. That's not impossible to solve. What is apparently more hard to solve is that the way that a browser page is rendered is one pass. It like looks at all the stuff it needs to look at, it performs layout, and then it's done performing layout. And of course, JavaScript can come along later and change some things and re-cause layout, but that our initial layout is a one pass system, as I understand it. And as soon as container queries exist, it's not anymore, and it becomes this cyclical, more complicated process, and no browsers are ready for their complicated browser page rendering process to be ready for that cyclical thing. And I don't know what to say about that. So that's why they don't exist right this second, I think, but there has been good writing recently about how to do it in JavaScript.
Yep. So the current, like, I guess, legal status here would be it has moved from the RICG, Responsive Issues Community Group, to the WICG, which is the Web Initiative Community Group. Is that right? But that sounds really mild, but this means, like, basically official look like WC3 people have picked it up and are kind of starting the work of writing the spec and doing everything. This includes people like Tantek Celik, I believe is how I pronounce his last name. I mostly read it, so I apologize if I murdered that last name. But Tantek, he's a big, historically important person in CSS land, so he's involved. Ethan Marcotte is also involved. I'm blanking on everybody's name. I think like people like Keith Grant are writing in, and Keith, I think, has written in EQCSS, I believe. Anyway, I'm blanking on all the names, and I apologize if you're involved, but there's a lot of people involved here, and they kind of have a board, and there's they do like weekly calls or semi-weekly calls to like figure out what they need to do to make container queries happen. And so there's two repos. It's WICG CQ-use cases. So you can follow there. And then there's WICG container-queries. So those would be the places to hang out and subscribe. I don't know, like for me, this is Dave Rupert talking. It seems like very smart people are handling this. So I'm not really like offering my opinions, but I can't stop you on the internet, but it would probably be helpful. Like we shouldn't all just crash this and just say, I want it. They know you want it. Like we need to like have like tangible, actionable things that we can do. So, and don't,
I think
don't
use cases are pretty fleshed out. You know, I don't think we need any more plus ones on this kind of thing. It's just like, I don't even know. There was word that Houdini might be able to handle this kind of thing. Although I mentioned that once on Twitter or something, and somebody told me that there's some kind of Houdini, even, you know, Houdini isn't just Houdini. There's lots of little parts to it that make it all Houdini-ized. I don't, you know, I'm terrible at this stuff, but the thing that would unlock the ability for Houdini to be container queries is not there yet. So right. Not ready for that either. I think the most notable development is that Resize Observer shipped in Chrome, and a lot of people said, well, okay, well, if you need this right now and you for some reason don't like the bunch of other JavaScript libraries that do this that don't use Resize Observer but use some other APIs, because I mean yeah, I don't know, imagine a really homebrew solution to this, some resize, some thing happens, maybe you even watch window dot, you know, resize or whatever, you measure the element with JavaScript because there's APIs to do that, and then you like drop classes onto elements or something, and then use those classes to design the inside of them. You can homebrew this kind of idea in JavaScript, certainly. There's ones that will parse your CSS out and see, you know, that are basically like CSS preprocessors, but kind of live somehow, you know, that do it. There's been a bunch of takes on this, you know, but the one that, you know, I think most people are behind is like, I wish, you know, Resize Observer was kind of built for this kind of thing, and I think Phil Walton published recently on using it, and it's kind of beautiful because it's not a huge library. It's just like, and it's not a library at all. It's like, this is how you would just bake it into your code, you know? Like it's just a handful of lines of code. So if you really want to do this, this is probably the way to go. It is, I think Resize Observer is Chrome only at the moment, but it's a sweet API, and I think everybody's signal and interest, so it seems like probably a pretty strong way forward. You know, you'd almost hate for it to get too much adoption, because then you're like, at least for this purpose, not the whole API, but this exact use case, because then it's just all the more ammunition for browser vendors to be like, nah, you don't need those, just do it this way. Whereas yeah. we really do want this in CSS.
Yeah, we really do, and I think there's a lot of, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot in JavaScript, I guess, like now I'm managing two things, you know, like I just want to manage style. That's what I'm trying to do. And I want to do that in style, not like manage, get my JS and my CSS in parity. That's my opinion, but it's in, I guess the answer, the TLDR is it's in the best state it's ever been. We got Resize Observer coming. CSS containment was a big kind of blocker too, like this idea that you can contain layout and paints and things like that. And so that was part of it. And so I think now with those two things on the table, we can maybe now start looking at container queries as a solution. So, but yeah, there's, yeah, I get very, this issue frustrates me, you know, cause like occasionally browsers will hop on Twitter and be like, what do developers want? You know? And it's like container queries, container queries, container queries, container queries. And they're like, yeah, that's hard. And so, and you're just like, why'd you ask me? You knew what my answer was. So anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. What would be funny is if they're sick of hearing it, maybe that I think it would be kind of cool to see a, like a statement, you know, it's kind of what we, not to derail this thing, but that's kind of what we wanted from AMP or whatever. It's just like, can you publish your response to these kind of things? Can there be an official page that's just like, hey, we're the Firefox team or the Chrome team or the Opera team or whatever. We think container queries are a good idea too. Here's the history of where we're at with that and no promises, but you know, if, I don't know. Like, is it, does corporate communication prevent that kind of thing? Like, why can't it, why does it have to be whispered or in comment threads instead of just being like, this is a major topic right now, we're just going to address it head on?
Or the response I always get is, you know, hopefully, you know, TPAC's coming up in a couple of weeks and hopefully we'll get to talk about it at TPAC. You know, it's like, what's a TPAC? But, you know, like, okay, I hope you do too, also talk about it. So anyway, but I will say, I think browsers are very aware and it's in progress, but it, you know, it still could be another 2 years, you know, yeah, until it's, until the feature is spec'd, you know, so.
And then it's not, yeah, I don't think we've gotten to the point yet where we're like, you're going to, that it will take time, but you're going to get this. It's not there yet, I don't think.
Yeah. Barring any, like, I mean, you had that 2018 guess. I mean, like for an implementation of some kind. So
yeah, I bet we'll get it.
But I think we, it's possible, but I think it's probably like one, I don't know, WizKid intern works really hard to land it. So we'll see. Like that.
Be that person. Pete Leedy writes in, I'd like to hear your opinion on front-end framework CSS helper or utility classes, whether they're good or bad or becoming overused or what. I've seen a lot of talk about this too lately. It's always been around, but I don't know, what was it, Bootstrap 4 or something that dropped with like more of them than has been there before? The idea of a helper library being something like ML4 is the margin left utility, the fourth one meaning it's 20 pixels or something instead of 5, 10, or 15. Or, you know, it's just a bunch of like little mini thingies to help out with CSS, because sometimes you just need to punch something over a little bit or just change the color on this one line. And I don't want to like come up with a name for it and then make that a class in my CSS. I just want a little helper library kind of thing to do it. So that's what he's talking about. The main argument I've heard against them is that they contradict basic separation of concerns principle that CSS was born out of. So overuse will make it harder to keep both clear and consistent styling across teams and also make it harder to make future changes or updates. On the other hand, it makes them easier to knock out a front end. So, and potentially keep style sheets smaller. Bootstrap 4, oh, I should have read ahead, has more of these utility classes like border top 0, MB3, etc. So I feel like it's almost encouraging certain types of designers or developers to begin relying on them and encourage bad design habits. We should also acknowledge the existence of libraries that are only those, you know, which is a form of atomic CSS, which is the whole idea is only do that. Only do that. You have no other CSS on the entire page, and you can theoretically do anything that CSS can do but by applying these classes, which is a whole thing in itself. I'll let Dave take it first.
You know, we're rolling out a pattern library for a big company right now, and you know, we did the interface inventory, split up the whole site into like, you know, hundreds of screenshots or whatever, and then we kind of identified, well, we're kind of dealing with about 30-ish components, and that builds out the whole entire site. Like we inventoried and kind of said, like, okay, over all these hundreds of pages, that really we can build out most of the site in about 30 components, using 30 components. However, what I'm noticing is when you stitch two elements together, you know, you kind of always want different things, you know, when these two things go together, you want like a border between them. And then if you put a border in between them, you need like a little bit of padding on the margin and the top and the margin. And so where we're kind of using utility classes, and I think they're actually awesome for this, is I call it the mortar, like the little, like the glue that goes in between two elements, how you glue elements together. I think, you know, these utility classes are awesome for this, and they like kind of start like, you know, they sort of start, kind of, it allows developers, rather than like going through the full official pattern library canonization process of like, well, does this, you know, can we use a different one? Can we modify one? Do we have to create a new one? Rather than going through that, you can use like a little bit of this mortar to kind of build your own component, but using all the pre-existing components and molecules and atoms or whatever. But you just have like this, but you can kind of add a little bit. I don't know. It's almost feeling too, right? Like you either want like a little bit of mortar or you want like a lot of mortar, like space in between the two elements. So that's kind of how we've been using utility classes. And I think it works out pretty well. We also have like, you know, we it's different. Like we don't have like one class per CSS rule. I think that's over the top for me. But I understand why people do that. But what we're kind of doing, you know, we'll have like a H1, H2, H3, H4, H5 style, you know, and some people hate that, you know, because like you'll have like H3 class H2. However, from this like atomic sort of setup, it's like you're saying this is the second largest heading we offer. So, but semantically, it needs to be an H3 on the.
I wonder if H2 would even qualify as a helper class or not. I mean, it is, and I've used that plenty of times. I think it's still a pretty good pattern, but it doesn't describe, you know, it's still like an abstraction. It's not saying font size 30.
Right. Mm. But yeah, so it's like, for me, I like the helper utility, but I'm not going so far as atomic, you know, where it's just controlling a single property. I do sometimes like border top or border margin, or we use like spacing. We don't say like margin or padding, which there is a difference, and maybe we do need both, but we use like spacing top large or something like that. So, and it's working out really, really well and adding a lot of flexibility. Otherwise you have to like go create, you know, list item with a lot of padding, list item with a little bit of padding, list item with a little bit of padding in a border, you know, like these would be separate classes you'd have to maintain. So I think overall, like if you have like a good set of components and a good set of like utilities that you use to stitch together components, I think that's proving out for us to be a pretty good architecture, and we can spin up whatever we want.
You've almost sold me on this idea. If I were to gone first, I would have said, don't like them. Because astonishingly, perhaps to my own self, I like the idea of all in or none at all. Like I don't mind the atomic CSS approach to it, because I've seen plenty of evidence of companies that are just like, God, our CSS sucks and it's a big problem for us and we really feel trapped by it. And like, I just wish we weren't in this position at all. And imagining them, or even seeing them, having switched over to something where it's like, all we have is utility libraries, this CSS will never grow or shrink ever. It's just is what it is. I can do all the styling we need to do, and it's just this flat constant in our site. I think that's kind of cool. And I, you know, applaud that type of effort, you know, like, oh, wow, nobody's afraid of the style sheet anymore. It's not affecting our performance anymore. How can that not be a win? That's going all in on utility libraries only. What I don't like to see is a little bit of both. This is a header primary, and it's got four properties associated to it, but it also has MB0 because I just wanted to nuke off the bottom margin of it. That seems like a mess. It seems like the worst of both worlds. Now you're building CSS that can still get away from you, that you can still be afraid of, that you still might have unused CSS in it, that has all that same stuff going on. and has a bunch of utility libraries mixed together. It seems like you didn't gain anything from the utility libraries. It's still just a crap show that way. So, but or not using them at all, things are very explicit. There's a one-to-one tie to this class and a place in the CSS that's styling that class. That's I like either or that, either all atomic or none. But Dave just made a full-throated argument for a both, so just do what you will.
Once I realized, like, for me, it's the how you're using it, you know, like, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're making a modal, and every time you make a modal, somebody's like, could we round the corners on this modal? And you're like, okay, you know, but like, should I make a whole new modal pattern, or should I just have a border rounded class, you know, like I could spit that out, and you know, and so it's kind of like balancing like flexibility and terseness, and which I like the terseness. It's like, use these things, and it should be, and you need to think about how these things apply to your design, and you're not just designing willy-nilly, you know, or there can be places in your website you can design willy-nilly, but we're being very strict, and then we're going to have a little, I guess, you know, tool chest of things we can do to shim and make things look a little different when needed. So that's my point of view. I should write about that. I should, just how we've been approaching it. So
cool. Please do. Writing is cool and good.
Writing is, I have a lot of drafts in my drafts folder. Hey guys, I'm new to web development. Hey, welcome to the club. This is Brighton Wright. And I'm pretty comfortable with HTML, CSS, and vanilla JavaScript. One thing that keeps tripping me up is web design. I seem to be completely incapable of designing a website that doesn't look super dated or even cheesy. Even when I try to design off a template, I can edit I can't seem to figure out how to make it look decent. What would you guys recommend for improving your eye for design?
I like that question. I mean, I wonder if you, it's definitely a skill that can be improved. Like, your taste is something that it evolves over time. And I think that's a huge, huge, huge deal. In that, if you already think you have great taste and never work on it and don't have that nagging feeling at the back of your mind that's just like, oh, the stuff I do is never quite like up to the par I wish it was, you know? I think that's a good sign. If you have that feeling, because that means next time your thing's going to be a little better because your taste is evolving and your desire to drive to get to that taste level you want to be is increasing. You got to have that. So if you don't have that, I don't know how to give it to you, but I hope that you have it. I hope everything that you create just isn't quite as awesome as you wanted it to be. Not to fuel your insecurity, but just to give you that drive that it's just like, I don't know, there's amazing things in this world and I want to create those amazing things and I have a work to go to get there. Mm-hmm. For really practical advice, this isn't an ad, but it has been a sponsor in the past.
Audible.com.
Yeah. We've never got Audible, have we? God dang it. We need some Audible bucks up in this
podcast. Casper mattress. I thought this up on my
Hey, we got a toothbrush that's round or whatever.
It's a hockey puck and you just put it in your mouth. Anyway. Okay, you were saying.
No, the guy's name is Eric Kennedy. Never met him, but I've met him through seeing his face on his videos. Has a course, you know, it's like a West Boss-like course, you know? It's called Learn UI Design, and it's just for you, Britton, I think. Like, it is like, let's look at design from a real practical thing. You know, let's practice it. Let's analyze designs, figure out why this works and why it doesn't. It's good looking design too. It feels very modern. And like, this is the course you could take. It is totally expensive. You know, okay. It's not like $1 million, but it's like high three digits kind of course. Yeah. And it has limited kind of signups. I think the enrollment I think it's happening right now, but you may have missed it. It only opens and closes once in a while.
Like cohorts kind of.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but I've watched a bunch of the videos, you know, like he gave me access to it when we were working on sponsorship, and I have an affiliate link if you'd like to click it. That would be useful to me. Yeah, yes, please. I think it does exactly what maybe you would hope it to do, and I've known actual human beings that take and swear by the course. It has a UX twist to it, too, and totally the way to go.
Yeah, no, my advice, I make things and then get feedback. I think that's the step we often skip in our industry, is getting like real feedback. Like, ask designers, hey, could you like kind of, I don't know, is there like, can you give me any honest critique? Because real designers should know how to critique. That's like, they go to school to learn how to critique design and things like that. So if you can partner with designers, they will be able to educate you and kind of give honest feedback and kind of point you in the right direction. I would say there's like two aspects of design. There's the visual effects, you know, but then there's also the how it works, like the function and the flow and the, you know, user experience stuff that can happen that's not visual. So I know you're probably asking like, how do I design visually? I would also say focus on that function aspect of design, because, you know, if you get that function right, I think that like goes way further than the visual. Like, you can have a crappy looking but very functional website or design or app or whatever. So I do this all the time. I make crappy looking but works pretty all right sort of stuff. So that's, you know, and you know, think of like the mobile experience and the desktop experience and things like that. Like, you got to just think through that whole thing, how it works and flows. And you can almost gray box out things and then try to apply design on top of that. But, you know, you can also maybe want to start with a big design idea and code that out too. So, and that's all I'd say. There's two kind of halves to that design coin.
Well, we're on the topic of massive topics.
And, yes.
Josh writes in about this, about PWAs. He says, what are your thoughts about progressive web apps support on desktop? I don't know if I've, I mean, I guess, I think like desktop browsers, or is there some movement to like make them native apps or something? I have no idea. But will it be a viable alternative to Electron apps? Electron being famous for packaging up web apps literally as native apps. So you can think of famous ones like Slack.
Atom.
Notion, I think, is probably an Electron app.
VS Code. So,
yeah, I'm intrigued by it because, I mean, what if, I don't know, we've never gone down this road exactly, but like CodePen Projects, wouldn't that be sweet if it was just an Electron and it worked on Windows and it worked wherever as a native app? It's has its own icon. You click it, it fires up, it's native. Is it as simple as us just like packaging that thing up with 5 lines of code and shipping it? I've always assumed no. And for one no reason is that I think people would very much expect it to work offline then, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like even if you can't send a message in Slack, you can still open it up and see what the conversations were. And it tells you that you're offline and you can still do some basic stuff. In order for it to be an Electron app, it's not just a freebie. There's still work to do. But I guess that's the case with PWAs too, is there's a whole checklist of work to get there. And I'm not sure if they're in the same bucket really.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to PWAs replacing a lot of Electron apps.
So they are in the same bucket.
You know? Yeah. So what's different is Electron is it's almost like a Docker container. It's like, I'm shipping this like edition of Chrome down to you, and Chrome is kind of behind the scenes, but it's running in an instance of Chrome, and then I'm piling in all the HTML, CSS, JavaScript. You know, it could be a whole bunch of pages, it could be just like, you know, JS framework or something, and then you're going to execute that locally. But PWAs and essentially can do the same thing. It through Service Worker, you know, once it's registered, it'll cache all that stuff locally. And so when you click the icon, it'll load up instantly. You know, it's sort of up to you how you're going to load it. So you think of like, an Electron app is like just a zip folder of Chrome plus some files coming down to you. And a PWA is just the files. And then it runs in whatever browser supports this feature. And so on desktop, there's a couple things coming. You can kind of do it with Chrome on Windows. You can kind of do it, or Edge is very all in on this. And Edge is going to have a different thing. Like, not only can you like save from the browser, I think, but their whole plan is like to take, like basically crawl with Bing, find a bunch of web manifests or whatever, and then kind of publish that in their store. So like, they're going to hydrate the Windows store with progressive web apps they crawled around the web.
I think there's two ways to see that. You can be like, that's cool. That's a great first step. That points towards these being totally more a thing that people expect and know about in the world and use, and it's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But I don't know. There's also like that seems a little half-assed. Is that really going to go anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Windows, it solves their kind of current problem, which is no one's building Windows apps. So like, and if you think about the apps you use day to day, here's in my dock. You ready? I got Edge. It's a browser. I've got Mail, which is actually just, I know just cause it was, I know who works on it, but that's like basically like a React app, I think. Code, that's a React app. I've got Slack, React app. I've got Spotify, React app. I mean, almost everything in my dock right now is just HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Like, I have even Hyper, that's just a React app. I mean, it's all like, I'm using web technologies, but they all ship with like their own instance of Chrome. Eventually, they could just like send me their HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and it's almost like a bookmark on my desktop. And then I just, you know, and they update that when they need to. They don't have to send me down a whole big binary. It looks like it's going to be pretty awesome. I know Chrome OS is going to get PWA support. Samsung Internet Browser has also like come up with some new PWA like workflows for like, you know, tablets and everything like that. So this, you know, PWAs on desktop, I think is going to be awesome. You know, there may be things you don't PWA on desktop. Like, I can't even think of what it would be, but maybe like you need like some server credentials or something locked down. So that could be a thing you'd still need Electron for, but I'm excited. So,
well, there you go. Tim Dunkel, huh?
Yeah, Tim Dunkel writes in, for several years now, I've been having problems with hover focus states sticking on iOS devices. This is mostly a problem when you are using a button for some kind of JavaScript-based UI. The user clicks the button to say, remove a filter, and the hover state remains. Oh, no. I have tried several different approaches to fixing this, but nothing ever felt quite right. I used to use Modernizer to detect touch devices, but then not apply the hover focus styles to those devices. But as we all know, you can't accurately detect touch devices these days.
I have a sneaking suspicion that you know the answer.
Yeah. So what you want is the new thing called Focus Visible, which is coming out, which is again in the WICG.
Is it a pseudo selector?
And it used to be called Focus Ring or something like that, based on Mozilla's Focus Ring property. But basically, this is like keyboard only focus. So when you tap a thing, you're still focused on it because that's where like the browser's focus, like that blue outline or whatever is, you know, or the dashed outline, that's where that's tracking. But Focus Visible is just keyboard only focus. So you can, you know, kind of like remove that state, you know, for unless they.
Well, what if you wanted it while your finger's on it to have a hover state, and then as soon as your finger's not on it anymore to not be there? That doesn't cover this.
I think does not. It's not hover. Doesn't is hover only like hover should only be when you're interacting with it or active probably.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have it all wrapped up in my, you got it. You got this sorted,
but check out Focus Visible. There's some, you know, if you go to what is Ali Cass, which is Rob Dodson. I'm just very excited about this. It's coming out, pretty soon. Or like, I think Rob is actually like cycled over to, he'd get cycled over to like Chrome development. So he's like a Chrome developer now. So he's like implementing this feature natively in, in Chrome. So I think that's kind of a cool thing. Let me here. I'll put a YouTube link in here for Focus Ring, but remember listener, it's been renamed to Focus Visible and it kind of is gonna, I think it solves our problems or at least for me, because that thing where you click a button and it still has a hover state is really frustrating. So, but it's probably just your visible state.
Love it. Now, this is almost rapid fire. I'm almost like solving people's problems. Who's got a problem?
Next. Hit me. Next. I actually got, here's another one. Ryan S. I know this one. Can you give the best recommendation for enterprise capable CMS? I work at a large company currently struggling to find an easy to use modern scalable CMS. We've been using Umbraco for a while, but find it limited widgets and integrations. Adobe CQ seems difficult to develop and requires a specialized skill set. You have evangelized Webflow several times, but it isn't locally hosted. While that's not a complete impediment, it's not ideal for our organization, and WordPress is off the table because we are .NET, therefore no PHP.
Whoa, the PHP is the big one there. As I'd say all the major, generally all the major CMSs are PHP.
Yeah, that's an interesting like limitation, you know, to put on yourself. But we had this question in the past, and Umbraco was like the like that was like the big, I guess, suggestion, like multiple people suggested it. You know, Sitecore from Microsoft is obviously kind of a thing you could use. What's the other one that people, SharePoint. And then somebody recommended SDL Tridion. Again, very cool names here. SDL.
So it's got to be enterprise or whatever, large scale. I don't know what that exactly means, but it means. It
means XML.
Means they. But they need to host it. You know, I've definitely seen this come up in a university setting before where it was like, we need a big time CMS that's ready for us, but we kind of don't want to host it, or I think they're going to host it, but they're not going to manage it. It's like this middle ground of, we don't really have an IT team for this, so we wanted somebody to like come out and, or maybe they have an IT team, but not developers, you know, like we can give you a rack and we can get this software installed on it and powered in our internal intranet or whatever, but we don't have a team of developers to sic on the CMS. So the CMS needs to be like ready to rock and roll on a self-installed system. So that's tricky. Maybe that is what, because I know that Adobe CQ was definitely in that realm, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I have a client there on a Java CMS called Crafter, not to be confused with Craft CMS, the PHP one, Crafter. And, you know, it's a big gnarly beast. But it's, you know, I think dependable at scale. So that's a, you know, you could start looking into Java stuff, but if the .NET's a limitation, it might be Umbraco. But I'm sure, you know, you talk to enough companies like Oracle or people like that, they'll be happy to help you like manage a website, you know? So.
Well, they're on Umbraco now. That's what he says. So.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious what like widgets and things do not exist, because every time you mention like .NET Enterprise CMS, like Umbraco is like the big one. So that's anyway. So hopefully, if anyone has any suggestions, please leave a comment or hit us up on the Twitter. We'll keep trying to find that mythical enterprise CMS that works for everybody. So. We'll get
There's a couple of, I kind of like this one about client credentials. Doug Mitchell writes in there, works in a small web dev shop. Actually, I feel like I've read this question a lot of times. I wonder if we've talked about it before, but that's okay. We'll talk about it fresh for the first time. So when you're in client work, which you are, Dave, but I'm sure there's shops that do like more frequency, probably have more clients in and out the door and stuff. I imagine that's what's kind of like in my limited agency experience. You know, I had lots of clients, you know, and we did a lot for them. We're like, because it's just maybe this is still true these days, but at the time it was like they needed a lot of hand-holding. We're going to help you buy the domain name. We'll even help you get your email set up on there. And but we kind of want you to own this stuff. Like, we didn't own anybody's domains. That was like off the limits. I do not want to be in charge of, you know, not paying the credit card bill on your freaking domain name and getting called about that. Like, it's our problem, you know, your domain name, your problem kind of thing. But imagine all these services. It's not just that, but it's hosting and it's who knows what else, maybe some monitoring services. All of a sudden there's, you know, 15 services or something that both you and your client need access to. That's a lot of passwords and logins and stuff to keep organized. And that's very sensitive data. How do you share that stuff between clients? It's not exactly what Doug wrote here, but that's what he's saying. Like, do you?
Yeah. No, there's, I can only think of like insecure ways, basically. You know, it's like, like we post it in a Slack thing and everyone, you know,
how bad is that?
Clicks a checkbox and you delete it whenever you're all done or whatever, you know. I know. Do you have .env files at all? Do you ever use those like on Ruby development? Was sure. Popular. Yeah. You know, it's like you just basically share a .env. I know people use like Keybase, .io, like they. What is that? That's like secure chat, kind of like.
Yeah,
like
Keybase is a good. That's a great option. Yeah,
look. PGP Keybase. Chat stuff.
A little nerdy, but you can get people set up on it. It's not that hard.
We do at Paravel. We have a team account on 1Password, which actually works pretty good. So that's kind of handy. We like share a team account, or I think we maybe even just share a one vault over like our, you know, business Dropbox, which maybe that's totally insecure, but in theory it should be like totally encrypted on that end, you know? So, maybe I'm offering way too much information. So, it's always like a thing, right? Like you basically have like a list of credentials you need to maintain and dozens of people probably need access to those credentials. So how do you do that? So
I don't know. What is Slack really that bad? It's pretty encrypted. That could be worse. You know, I mean, I guess your Slack gets broken into and that's a problem, but that would be true of anything, you know, even iMessage and WhatsApp and stuff like that is pretty encrypted, right? I don't think people can sniff that stuff over the wire. It's not that bad. What if you share a Dropbox folder and have a text file in there? I mean, it doesn't seem like the end of the world. That's all HTTPS and stuff. It seems like there's lots of ways to do it. I'm a huge fan of it. I think I'm in like 7 1Password vaults with people. I know that's a Mac OS app, but I think there's alternatives for all the different platforms of like password managers that have kind of team-like features. The shared vaults thing on 1Password is great, man.
Yeah. You're saying they keep a key pass database of credentials? So that's, do you know anything about YubiKeys, Chris? YubiKey?
About UB40?
YubiKey is like a number one security for two-factor authentication. So I don't know. I don't know too much about it, but all the cool people I know who work in big businesses have it. But it's basically just a little USB chip that you chuck into a available USB thing and that does kind of your two-factor auth, I guess.
Think about it.
Yeah, so maybe there's something that could be done there, you know what I mean? So I don't know though.
These for $18 or whatever. I don't know why this made me think of this, but somebody's like, "Oh, Amazon's got this thing now where you like give them the keys to your house." and they just like open up your door and just chuck your packages inside. But they also like install a camera or something, maybe for liability or something.
Yeah.
And it's just like free. I was like, well, how much money does the company have to make to like dispatch somebody out to your house to like install a special lock and camera? Like, how much paper towel do you have to buy to qualify for that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of funny. Just like packages get stolen because you put these big brown packages on a doorstep, and
yeah, it's a way that's what it's meant to solve.
Solution to not getting your $100 Instapot stolen is to allow have Amazon install a remote unlocker in your house, and you let them come inside your house.
Yeah, it's like big solutions to little problems. You know, like, have you considered hypnosis so that you don't want an Instapot anymore?
Yeah. A dog?
Yeah.
I don't know. Dogs that bark at things? I don't know. What? I don't know. A little box-sized doggy door in your garage where people just chuck things in. I don't know. Is that that's probably not a good solution, but well.
I always thought like a toy box on your porch wouldn't be so bad, you know? That maybe like this that has a sign on the top of it, but facing up so you can't see it from the street. But like, hi, delivery people, this is our package hole. Please put packages in it.
Yeah. This is my package.
Like a giant kid's toy box kind of.
Yeah. This is my package porch. So it can, yeah. You know, that this is tangentially related about client stuff. I had a client recently, I feel like there's maybe like a product in this like solvable space between like, you know, sharing passwords between multi-company kind of things. Because I recently had a client and they, you know, were getting me onboarded into the account and they like kind of said, oh, okay. Well, all of our stuff is like through our email address, like, you know, company.com. So you need a company.com email to get into the Slack, to get into the everything, to get in this third party, fourth party, fifth party service to be under our accounts. And so they had to like create an email account for me just for a contract and to like get in here and like do all these things. So that it wasn't the end of the world. It was fine. But it's very interesting, like just security models here, like how people share credentials and security models. I think people just kind of have like a have what works kind of thing. But it would be, I think, I don't know. It just seems like there's a best convention that people could do or something. So it was kind of a hassle and took a couple of days to get the email and the everything going. So, but anyway, I don't know. Maybe you need like I'm trying to brainstorm products for you and I can't do it. So, all right, Chris, should we wrap it up here? This episode, or you got one more?
I guess I'll just say one more just because then we've completed our list of the ones that we picked out. There's some kind of self, you know, like patting on the back that we estimated properly for once.
Yeah, we did it.
This is from Ed Brandt, who's talking about, he's an artist who enjoys rolling his own site. It appears light boxes are the thing for displaying work. It's the expectation of my audience, but I really dislike them. I wish I could horizontally scroll a page, but the eliminates quick scanning of thumbnails in a grid. I worry about accessibility, don't like how it wrangles the markup, and despite responsive layout and gestures, it's still poor presentation on mobile. I was wondering if you had any advice, solutions, ideas, otherwise, that would be a good alternative to Lightbox presentation. The method uses Google's uses for image searching is nice, but it seems even more complicated. So, yeah, that's a good point. Google image search is a pretty unique UI that you don't see around a lot, right? Like, it's definitely like a masonry-like looking grid layout, but you click on one and things kind of move out of the way for it to present that one larger. It's a pretty nice little yeah, setup.
Film strip where you zoom in.
And I think that the grid where you click and a literal light box comes up is like more and more rare. I don't know if maybe it just has like a, I don't know, old school feel to it that people don't like. Although Ed, you're saying that's, you see it primarily, but don't like it.
Yeah, I wonder if there's like a middle ground, you know, like the you know, like the visual treatment or whatever doesn't have to be like light boxy, you know, like two little icons to go left and right in a shadow, and you know, like it, maybe it could look more full pagey or something like that. I think the problem with like art and photography specifically is often like orientation, you know, like portrait art on a landscape screen needs like black bars, like to fit in there full, like to be as big as possible. You always want it as big as possible. Right. And then photos on a portrait screen, like a tablet, always need black bars on the top and bottom. And it's like, like that's always seems to be like the big problem. So
I would say that the missing ingredient here is UX for exactly, you know, what are you exactly trying to do? Who is exactly it for before we make any decisions? Because there's lots of patterns that we can reach for. We could invent new patterns, but to just armchair tell you what the best pattern is, I'm want to do that all the time and is probably a bad habit because it's like, what is it? You know, I can imagine, here's one scenario. You're a photographer. Maybe that's the type of artist you are and you need to send your client 500 photos for them to look through quickly. I would think a grid is probably an appropriate UI for that because there's so many of them. They need to go up and down quickly and see probably what their favorites are or whatever. They just need to open one quick and see it bigger and then close it and then keep scanning the film strip or whatever. And that forcing them to horizontally scroll through full sizes is like not good UX for that potentially. Whereas, or what if you only have like five things and you want to see them big? Well, then maybe make like a really big slider or something, or maybe like watch somebody try to use your website in one or different ways, or ask them what they need from you or whatever. There's just detail that we don't have here. And I guess I'm throwing that in there because I think that I'm thinking about that more and more recently, that UX is such a big deal. You know, it doesn't matter what patterns exist out there. You need to figure out what you got and who's using it and do the right thing for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you're not looking for like recommendations, but, there was that like photo swipe, you know, like there's a couple of like good JavaScript libraries that do have like kind of this interactive feel, you know, that aren't exactly like it has like horizontal swipe for like, to like zap through photos and stuff like that. So you can like have that grid view and that, you know, kind of swipe view. With CSS Grid, you could kind of build out a really cool grid, like programmatically too, and object fit, you know, like you could build out pretty cool things, yeah, like for your thumbnail grid, you know, and then make it pretty cool. But I'm going to put a link for photo swipe in the show notes. I think it's got kind of that Google thing where you're like, you're choosing one photo and then you like just swipe left and right to kind of see the next ones, you know? So
yeah. I remember living through this it was one of the like early successes I had in open source was to make this like anything slider thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a carousel. It was a jQuery based carousel. And it just was interesting in that it, you know, was somewhat popular. It had the lots of features. I got help on it. It went through lots of versions and iterations. It had themes and stuff. And it kept growing and growing and growing. And it was good. And eventually I just kind of like stepped away from it because I just didn't have time. And, you know, interest wanes and stuff like that. And then it kind of sat dormant for a while and had other maintainers, you know, and thanks to everybody who worked on that. But then eventually a new kind of generation of them came out. I specifically remember like Owl Carousel. It was like a fun one that people liked that one. But I was like, you know, I really just straight up don't recommend our jQuery one anymore. I mean, maybe you could make it work, but the dependency was jQuery, which is a little heavy. But more importantly, it didn't have Flick, you know, it didn't have touch events, which is a big deal. And it really wasn't even responsive. It wasn't naturally a flexible thing, which is just so bizarre to think about these days, but that was the case. And so I was like, if you're going to pick a library, it's got to, I think at a minimum, it's got to have kind of mobile support kind of situation and swipeability, like a nice, you know, some physics kind of feeling to it. And so, yeah, PhotoSwipe does look pretty good. It looks like it's quite built for, and you don't even get the carousel look until you open one big. They just looks like some photos. And then as soon as you tap one, then you get the, the more full-featured experience, which is pretty neat. It looks fast. It looks nice. I always mention Dave DeSandro's Flickity because that really has nice physics to it and lots of options if you need, like, one that just looks like a carousel right out of the go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. You know, and yeah, if you just want, like, the film strip to kind of browse through, you could probably code your own, like, click to go full screeny kind of thing, you know, if you wanted kind of that sort of thing. But yeah, there you go. Hopefully that helps. A couple options. But yeah, if you, or spend the time and come up with the like big next idea and how to present photos. I'm sure you could probably make a startup out of it and like get a bajillion in funding.
I recommend, so, you know, an open source library that you lose interest in over the years too.
Yeah, that could also help kickstart your blog. So there you go. So, lots of options. Hey, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast or choice. Be sure to star her favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. If you want to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one.
Hey, folks, we got a job opening to tell you about this week on Shop Talk Show. The place is called Bonfire Studios, and the website is hellobonfire.com. It's a digital agency. Go to the website. It's so classy. There's like this dark background, and you can see the sparks and embers of a bonfire like rising up. It's like the classiest thing I've ever seen. I absolutely love it. So what they're looking for is a kick-ass front-end developer, you know, so you. And it's about 30 minutes north of Boston in Andover, Massachusetts. And they're looking with, you know, an intermediate level front-end developer to work with the rest of the team and work with the clients and get acquainted and get into this agency lifestyle. Competitive pay, flexible hours, you know, it's at a cool downtown office with good food and beer and tacos and all this stuff. They're looking for somebody with a passion for the web and the mobile web and app development and UX and that stuff. You know, you're a front-end developer, but you care about everything. You're an enthusiastic team player, you know, you're just a go the extra mile kind of person. So, you know, there's some bonus point stuff here. You know, you should have a understanding of SEO, you know, frameworks like GreenSock and CSS, JavaScript animations is a bonus. If you know Craft and Craft plugin development, that's kind of a bonus. If you're into, you know, all the acronyms, PHP, Git, Sass, Gulp, Node.js, React.js, Ruby on Rails, all that stuff is going to come up in this agency lifestyle. So the, you know, they're looking for a kick-ass front-end developer. That's you. The place is called Bonfire Studios. There, of course, there'll be a URL to direct you to the job posting so you can be clear that it's all you in the show notes, but the, you know, the URL to their agency website is hellobonfire.com. Go apply for it. You got this.
Chris, do you have anything else?
Shoptalkshow.com.